Economic Snapshot with Windermere Chief Economist Matthew Gardner. I did see a newspaper headline that despite our worst fears, businesses are snapping up office space in downtown Seattle. Is that what you're seeing?
Yes, it is. And it's interesting. And to a degree, half of me wants to be surprised, but the other half doesn't. I think that there are still a lot of companies trying to figure out what they are going to do and how their businesses are going to look going forward. But on the other hand, I think it doesn't surprise me. I think as we continue to reopen, people are going to go back into their offices, likely many of them not full time, but part-time. So yeah, given that, I think it's something which we should expect to see continuing as we move forward through the balance of the year.
So living in the city will be fun again?
Here's hoping at some point. I don't think we're there yet, but I as I've said on several occasions, I think that dismiss downtown Seattle ad hoc is really underestimating what Seattle is and will be again.
Why is it that Washington State was named the best state in the nation by U.S. News and World Report, but a survey of, I think it was CEOs, actually has us near the bottom of the list? What gives?
Well, I think the positives in terms of is that first article you mentioned is concerned. We are a remarkable location. We've got very, very talented, et cetera, et cetera. We've obviously got great outdoor activities, open space, these kinds of things. And that means that people do want to come here. And we continue to see that. Certainly a lot of people coming out of California and most other parts of the Western United States. On the business side, however, it's a cost thing more than anything else. And I say cost based upon a lot of it is because of housing and housing costs, because there must be a relationship between how much a company has to pay their employee and what it costs to live. And we are certainly at that inflection point. And what is going to be interesting as we go forward is that how long is it going to take before businesses say, I can't afford to pay people what they need in order to live in Seattle. And therefore, I'm going to start looking at some other potentially cheaper markets. And I think because of COVID-19, we might see that magnified a little bit more. And companies choosing not to be in Seattle, but maybe to be in Spokane. Housing costs are significantly lower, or hopefully not, out of state. And that would be, we've seen a lot of interest from companies in Idaho, certainly around Boise, and even Las Vegas, because of cost of living. So I think we really have a bit of a disparity there between the great parts about Seattle and the not so great. And the not so great tends to be driven by company CEOs and CFOs.
What about Texas? Texas was the big winner in the population race in this last census. They're going to get, a couple more members of Congress. And I was talking with David Farenthold from Washington Post, who comes from Houston. I was asking him what Texas secret is, and he says it's basically their policy is if you want to build it.
Yeah.
The faster you can build it, the better. Do you agree with that?
Yes, it's true. I mean, they certainly have the space. And what we are seeing a lot of interest, specifically when it comes to Texas, is around Austin. Austin is becoming a very major technology center. It is, relative to the rest of Texas, remarkably liberal. And quite frankly, Austin is a very cool city unto itself.
So
we are seeing a lot of people move in that direction, less so to Dallas, Houston, obviously, and those other more magnified cities. But Austin's come up a lot in the last couple of years as being a very hip place to live, but also one that is relatively affordable.
Yeah. So do we need to compete with that? And what would we have to do in terms of making housing more affordable? We're failing spectacularly because I see prices in the latest multiple listings report going up. Let's see, King 15%, Snohomish 24%. Yeah, Pierce 23. So there you go. I mean, it's great if you're an owner, right?
Oh, no, it is. Well, it's interesting to see in the numbers that you just mentioned. Certainly, the prices are just extraordinary. But if you look at the number of pending sales, let's say, deals that haven't closed yet but have been agreed, up by 77% in King County. Now, that's extreme to the nth degree. But again, we've got to look at what was going on last April when real estate was not considered to be an industry where you had to be open. that stopped. So we have to be a little bit cautious there. But it was pleasing to see that there are now more homes for sale than we've seen in the last couple of months. So we've seen an increase in listings. That's good, because we'll see more supply. And with more supply, hopefully some of the home would-be home buyers out there that are suffering from buyer fatigue, well, they might get some more choice. But more than that, with more choice, we're seeing actually an interesting drop in the average and the median list, not sale price. Mm-hmm. And that tells me one thing, as that if it continues, then we're going to see sales price growth not turn negative, but start to soften somewhat and get away from those 15, 20, 25% increases that we saw year over year in April.
Yeah. With all this spending going on at the federal level, what's the forecast for mortgage rates?
Mortgage rates are interesting. They certainly took a notch up as the vaccine distribution became better, and the expectation was we were going to see the economy reopen. Now, when that happens, we tend to see a move away from the bond market and more into equities. And when that happens, price of bonds has to drop. The yield, the interest rate you get has to rise. And interest rates on mortgages are tied directly to the yield on 10-year treasuries. So we saw those go up. They've softened. They kind of leveled off a bit. My expectation is that rates are going to rise. Bottom line is anyone out there looking for a mortgage, 30-year fixed, starting with a two handle, well, they're behind us. But I don't expect to see 4% mortgages coming into play until probably sometime early to mid next year. So they're going to be rising slowly, but still stay in that mid 3% range for most of the year.
And the median price of a single family house in King County is now $750,000?
It's actually more than that. If you look at a combination of single family and multifamily, 750. Single family on its own in King County, $830,000.
You think you're going to hit $1 million?
Well, we're already seeing. So essentially, to actually dig deeper into the numbers, is that, I mean, North Seattle, the average price there is now over $1 million. So we know Mercer Island, obviously, Kirkland, Sammamish is getting close. So I think it's going to take a while before we could get to that $1 million. It's certainly not going to be this year. It's going to take some time. We have select submarkets, neighborhoods, absolutely, that are above that level. But I think the median at above $1 million for King County as a whole, that's a ways away yet.
Matthew Gardner, Chief Economist, Windermere Real Estate. Thank you, Matthew.
You are always welcome, Dave. Take care.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now, sponsored by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated. Thanksgiving is usually a time for celebration with loved ones. However, that's the day one Dallas woman got a devastating diagnosis that threatened plans for her future. Then one nurse stepped up to help. CBS's Maria Villarreal has the story. Motherhood was a dream Erica Gray nearly lost 7 years ago.
I got the call on Thanksgiving Day, which is never a good sign when you hear from your doctor on Thanksgiving Day. Yeah. Listen, you're stage 3 cervical cancer.
How old were you?
27.
An aggressive treatment would have consequences.
The option we went with, of course, was a radical hysterectomy.
Why?
If we had done chemo and radiation, it would have affected my fertility anyway.
The surgery left Gray cancer-free but unable to carry a child. The oncologist who saved her life would also help her and her husband, Richard, create a new one.
One of my operating room nurses mentioned that she'd had two easy pregnancies and was considering surrogacy. I thought, well, it's meant to be, and I helped get them connected.
The connection between strangers was instant.
We just hit it off. We sat there for 3 hours. We were hugging, and they're like, we're going to call the agency tomorrow.
And last summer, cause for celebration. Baby Richard arrived in March to an extended family bonded by love, sacrifice, and modern medicine.
It's so incredible. I mean, I just can't wait to watch him grow.
Mireya Villarreal, CBS News, Dallas.
That is a nice story. 7:47 and now from the Gian Ursula Show, which starts at 9 o'clock right here on Cairo Radio, here is G. Scott. I thought we'd talk about positivity this morning, G, because you seem like a pretty positive person. The only way, Colleen is probably edges you out a little bit.
Is, just a little, huh?
She's relentlessly positive, yeah. Even when there's really no good reason to be. Right. But you too. I mean, and so the question is, what's your secret? So you have, for example, the Mariners. They got no hit yesterday, right? They were humiliated, and yet they have to come back today, you know, and play again. And I know you've been in that situation. So what's the secret?
Got to have a bad memory. You got to have a bad memory, and you have to take the rearview mirror off in your car. You know, I think that I'm trying to get better at it every day. And I think a lot of times I just think about what I'm grateful for, right? Mm-hmm. What I have now. And so much of life is always wanting and thinking that you need to have more things. And so, and you start, especially social media makes you feel like you need more. You need a bigger house. You need a better lawn. You need better furniture. You need a better kitchen cabinets. It can use more and more and more. And I think that we don't spend enough time thinking about what we are grateful for, what we have. And so as for me, personally, and for the Mariners, as they were no hit by John Means, the Mariners need to have a bad memory. No, don't think about being no hit yesterday. Don't think about the fact that you haven't been to the playoffs in 20 years. Don't think about that, right? You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying?
Just list all the things we're not going to think about.
Yeah. So right.
Just
so
put them out there, and then they don't own you. You own them, right? Release them.
Yeah. And another thing, one of the sayings that my dad used to always say to me is, "Champ, show me who your friends are and I'll show you where you're going." And he would always say that. And I believe that to be true in life. Like, we usually have about 3 to maybe 5 people that we, outside of our coworkers, that we maybe chat with, text with, or call every single day. Well, those conversations and what we're talking about, those things have a impact on us, whether we know it or not, what we listen to, what we watch. So I think my secret, guys, is this, and this is the truth. I focus more on what I have and what I'm grateful for, because there were times 10 years ago that I would have never thought that I would be where I am at. I'm at today. And so I just think it's all about being grateful for what you have. And so whatever it is, you might be what you have and what you're grateful for might be different than mine, or different than your friends or your loved ones.
Also, too, putting it into perspective, I think that helped me a lot in my career as well, when you'd make a mistake on air or this and that. And I had a mentor along the way, Eric Slocum, rest in peace, where he would say, "Colleen, we're not brain surgeons. Nobody dies when you make a mistake." And it's like, yeah, that kind of puts it in perspective for you, that what we're doing in the grand scheme of things is not as important as, say, a brain surgeon. And the same thing with the Mariners' loss, right? Like, nobody died because of the Mariners' loss yesterday. So let's move on. And on to the next game. It's all about perspective. Gee, I think you're right.
Yeah. And usually, right, like, usually the negativity and what we, how can I say this? Most of the time, we draw from what others are saying. That's the truth, right? Like, we might say, "Ooh-wee, I've gained a few pounds." But if somebody else says, "Ooh-wee, you've gained a few pounds,"
yeah,
it just hits a little heavier when somebody else says it. So a lot of society's problems right now are what we think about others' opinion of us. If we can slow that down, right? Like, sometimes, so for, here's just a simple example, I'll explain this. My son, who's at Ohio State, right? And in the very beginning, there were games in which he didn't play, right? So he didn't play. And so there would be people out there in the social media world that would, "Ha ha, you didn't play and you didn't do all those things, ha ha ha." And it started to bother him a little bit. Mm-hmm. But then we had a conversation and I said, "Well, wait a minute, hold on. 10 years ago, it was a dream for you to be able to play college football.
That's right.
And now you're playing college football and you're in that dream right now. You're literally in that dream. and now you want more? You're playing with house money right now. So you are living that dream. You are doing what less than 2% of the United States of America is doing, but you're letting someone that's a part of the 98% try to draw negativity out of you. So the point going forward is just appreciate where you're at, son. And at the end of the day, whether you play pro football or not, it doesn't matter. You're living the dream still. You're still in that dream. As a matter of fact, to be honest with you guys, I'm living a dream. If you would have told, if you would have told me 10 years ago when I was living in my car, that, hey, gee, don't worry. One day you'll be hanging out with Colleen and Dave on every single morning, Monday through Friday. That I would have said, yeah, right.
That making that radio dream. Money.
Pew, pew, pew.
So that's the secret.
That's radio the secret. Money.
Well, I feel better already.
Hey, what? Hey, hey, from now on, can we just talk positive stuff every time we come on?
This is absolutely.
This is this
hello.
Is
you're like talking to the mother of the daily dose of kindness. Let's do it.
Yeah. So don't bring up the Mariners again.
No. Next on Seattle's Morning News, we're going to go to Amari Salisbury from Converge Media. But let's also take about 40 seconds to remember what happened in August of last year. Cue the post-chop report.
Mayor Durkin doesn't like it.
I hate seeing the wall.
Neither does incoming SPD Chief Adrian Diaz.
I would love to not have a wall. I know that it creates a barrier for people to feel connected.
But both say their options are limited, with some protesters setting fires and hurling Molotov cocktails at the building as recent as last night.
You can do one of two things. You can station police around it to be the defense mechanism, which we saw what happened with that. Escalation of violence night after night after night, and police then having to go and interact with the crowds. Or you put a wall.
The mayor says they'll take a close look at the situation to see how quickly the precinct can be reintegrated with the community it serves.
So 9 months for the reintegration process to begin, but the wall is coming down around the Seattle Police East Precinct. So, Omari, are they asking for trouble by doing this?
No, I don't think they're asking for trouble. I think this is a natural progression, a lot of what we've seen here in Seattle. You know, there's been a constant evolution of what's been occurring here, basically in the streets, and what's been occurring here in legislation and everything else. This just seems like a natural occurrence. People wanted that wall to come down for a long time. A lot of people clearly, of course, never wanted it to go up.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good to hear. And Hannah, you were there, of course, covering the demonstrations. What do you think about this?
I think there's been calls for months and months, like Amari just said, for this to come down. It was, you know, from everything from it was an eyesore to it was danger for people who had to bike or walk by there. And it just marks, I think, to some degree, what is a somewhat negative period for the Seattle area with the CHOP, not what it started as, but what it ended up becoming and some of the things that happened there. So I think they had to get it down. It still has, though, a very large fence. It still looks like kind of a shelled off police station, which is should be there to protect the public. So I think that's the big argument. There's still another fence there.
Right. Now, we have to, as depressing as it is to contemplate, we have to prepare for what happens the next time there is a police shooting that seems to be unjustified. And in a lot of cities, it just means automatic demonstrations and automatic confrontations with the police. So, Omari, I mean, you're probably closer to the sense of the community there in Capitol Hill than anybody else. You've talked to all sides of this story. What is the mood? Is it a hair trigger? Or are people ready to, you know, let the admittedly slow wheels of reform continue to move?
Well, I mean, let's start at the end there. I don't think the wheels of reform, at least in the state of Washington, are actually moving at light speed when you compare it to the rest of America. There's been actual real tangible change here on the streets in Seattle and in the state of Washington, and we saw that in that incredible session there in the legislature. While other parts of America might be moving slowly, state of Washington's actually moving incredibly fast. Secondly, I think that it's a narrative the people are going to do this, the people are going to do that. You know, let's be clear that on June 1st, 2020, peaceful protesters wanted to march peacefully past the precinct. Mm-hmm. The Seattle Police Department decided to stop peaceful citizens of Seattle from marching past the precinct. The SPD did that. SPD then decided to abandon their own precinct. I was out there. No one wanted the precinct. The precinct wasn't under attack. Even the FBI can't confirm that it was under attack. The Seattle Police Department abandoned their own precinct. Then the Seattle Police Department had to come back and deal with these issues and put up their wall. So I think instead of pointing the finger at the citizens, we need to point the finger back at the SPD and say, like, hey, man, what's going on? How come you didn't trust the citizens to just march past the precinct?
And that was what the whole thing, right? The whole pink umbrella incident. I think you were on one side of that. I was on the other, Amari, where that I had come up with that march. I'd been with them most of the day, and they did just want to go up and take the hard left or right and just make their point. And they were, it was a whole plan throughout the day to block them. And that's where you saw really big shows of force with the state patrol out there.
Right. And I think we need to be important. I think it's important as members of the media that we don't fall prey just to SPD's narratives about things and say what the public's this and that. You have to remember that the Seattle Police Department is the one who created the line on Capitol Hill. The Seattle Police Department is what led to the Western Barricade. And so now when you talk about what's the tone on the street and everything else, you know, the tone in the city is a bit different right now. At one point, you know, of course, you had the whole city, all kinds of different groups, black people, white people, somewhere in between, different ideologies, all on the streets around George Floyd, right? Now, and like we saw this with the George Floyd verdict, so many media people called me and government people, what are black people going to do? What are black people going to do? You know, they found Chauvin guilty. I said, black people going to be at home hugging and loving on each other and trying to deal with their emotions and everything else. And that's exactly what happened, you know. Mm-hmm. And so when we saw that night of the verdict here in Seattle, black people wasn't out there in the streets. Black people were in their community, in their barbershops, in their restaurants, trying to internalize what occurred. So, I just say that we shouldn't fall prey to any fear tactic that might be propagated out there to say that the citizens of Seattle are on a hair trigger and going to go crazy.
So we have. So in other words, this fear of what are they calling now? Antifa, the Black Bloc, whatever it is, they're no longer going to hide among demonstrators and
there's no one to hide among.
The best thing is they're out. They're out there. But excuse me. The best thing is it's like white Seattle. Go get your kids. You see what I'm saying? I mean, here's another thing we need to tear down, because it's always like this assumption that this is black people, black youth, this out there in the streets, white Seattle, white community organizers, white preachers, white rabbis, go get your kids, because that's who's out there. And that's what needs to be addressed. And to make a whole city culpable, especially black people in my neighborhood, black people in the Central District, black people in Rainier, in the South Bend, they're not out there like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know the last time we talked, you were pretty upset. You felt that the BLM cause had been co-opted by people who really had nothing to do with it and were just there for the fight.
Yeah, and so let's put that in perspective. You're talking about 40 people. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You're talking about 40, 60 people, whatever their numbers are. So let's have this conversation in perspective of, like, okay, what's really happening out here? What's really going on? And so is that total number worth what we're talking about here? And then you bring up an important point, Dave Ross. There's an anti-police movement, and then there's a movement for the value of black lives. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they coalesce around police issues, but it's two separate movements that's out there on the street. The movement that's out there on the streets that a lot of people see, Black Bloc, I don't know their whole philosophy, ideology, I won't speak on it, but it's more focused on, you know, anti-police, anti a few other things. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's for the value of black lives. Black, you know, and when you find that a lot of times when people who are for the value of black lives or Black Lives Matter, they meet all over the place, do all kinds of things, teach-ins and all everything else. Those people aren't necessarily there. So, you know, people in Seattle should be clear that anti-police protesters doesn't equate people who are protesting for the value of black lives.
Important point to my hand. Are you going to say something?
I echo what Amari said. It hasn't been, you know, what we saw in the beginning of after George Floyd's death, that really amazing coming together of all communities and those types of marches and protests. That has not been seen for quite some time, if I'm right, Amari.
No, I mean, it hasn't. I mean, it was something incredible, something very special. It hasn't been seen in a long time. And a lot of people, you got to remember, so July 25th was the last time that we really saw all these different groups there out there. It was even a wall of moms. That July 25th, the wall of moms got their butt smacked. Like SPD rolled July 25th. It wasn't nothing the wall of moms would do. Somebody threw a device over at the East Precinct. It broke a window, and, man, it went down. And that was the last time that you really saw a protest that had so many mixtures of different groups, advocacy groups, just random people being in the mix. Like I said, that was July 25th. And I think when people saw how that went down that day, a lot of people, you know,
split off and we're
started
done.
To dissipate. Yeah. Exactly, or focused on their specific thing away from the street.
Amari Salisbury from Converge Media and our own Hannah Scott. Thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
836 Seattle's Morning News. It's a crisis that went unnoticed or ignored for years, but the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls is finally being bumped up on the priority list, largely because of the efforts of some local Native American women. With the report, here is Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Violence against Native American women and girls is no secret to tribal communities, but from law enforcement to media and beyond, that disproportionately high number of Native American women to go missing or be murdered has never been given the attention it requires. Until now. From the local to the state and national level, this year's National Missing Murdered Indigenous Women Day of Remembrance was surrounded by announcements highlighting fresh efforts to address this issue, including President Biden announcing this week that he was making addressing missing and murdered Native American women and girls a priority. And then the news yesterday from our state attorney general that he will be coordinating a new task force that will look into why these rates are so high, especially in Washington state. The attention now going toward missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, a direct result of years of efforts from Native American women, including local leaders here in our state.
It's no accident that the three Debs got this done, Deborah Juarez, Deborah Lekanoff, and Interior Secretary Deb Holland. Me being at a city level and being elected and Indigenous, Deb Lekanoff being at a state level and being Indigenous, and Secretary of Interior Deb Holland, who took it to the national level. So we have three Native women, two of which are lawyers, all of them elected, lived experience, advocates, lawyers, educators, involved in Indian country. This is why representation matters.
Seattle City Councilmember Deborah Juarez, among those leading efforts for systemic change in this area and how missing and murdered Native peoples are handled.
A.G. Ferguson with Deborah Lekanoff is doing the statewide task force with a budget proviso. So they're actually funding it. So we did all this in fall of 2019 at a city level, getting all of our information from the grassroots organization, Trusted Messengers, that is the Seattle Indian Health Board, the Urban Indian Health Institute, which is Abigail Echohawk. I just can't tell you how natural, how organic the progression has been, in which it's been Native women, like I said, advocates, scholars, lawyers, leaders, mothers, daughters, even before we were elected. We were involved in this process and in this struggle.
Back in 2016, the first real attention this issue got came from a Canadian report that first drew widespread attention to the issue. Then in 2018, Seattle's Urban Indian Health Institute published a report detailing the issue and around the U.S. The Urban Indian Health Institute then presented that report in Juarez's committee at the City Council, revealing that in their work of 71 major cities, Seattle ranked number one with the highest number of cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, along with a series of recommendations that were presented in that meeting. Then in September of 2019, Juarez sponsored a resolution acknowledging the responsibility to address this issue. And in November, when the budget passed, $200,000 was included to specifically address the issue of murdered and missing endangered women and girls, including for a specific position within the Seattle Police Department. But other than that, there hasn't been much funding at any level. And then this week, as we said, the Biden administration declared a proclamation on Missing and Murdered Indigenous Persons Awareness Day. And along with that, yesterday, we heard from A.G. Ferguson about this new statewide task force.
You name it, bring them around the table. with a common purpose, compiling all the information that folks have. Anecdotal, individual stories from families, from tribes, from law enforcement agencies, bring all that together.
For the very first time, we are seeing the voices of families being elevated, the voices of survivors, and we are working towards the change that our community has been shouting and crying for.
Abigail Echohawk with Seattle's Urban Indian Health Institute that published that initial report back in 2018 says this is a long time coming.
We have to address this crisis. We cannot continue to let people die. This task force is going to be one of the ones that is truly representative and is going to be led by the needs of tribal communities.
Flores is thrilled to have all of this attention coming towards this issue and looks forward to what comes next. One thing that sticks out at her, though.
Here we are again, starting with missing and murdered, saying, government, when our women go missing, our girls, when they go missing, you have to go looking for them. They can't just disappear. And this has been going on for decades.
All right, it's Hannah Scott. The problem here, of course, is that it's sometimes unclear as to whether tribal or non-tribal authorities investigate these things, and it goes back to sexual assault. In the U.S., Native American women are more than twice as likely to experience violence than any other demographic group. One in three Native women is sexually assaulted during her life. 67% of those assaults are perpetrated by non-natives.
You can ring my bell.
This is Seattle's Morning News. I suddenly like Melinda Gates because I feel like I'm meeting her for the first time because she has now opened up a little bit about why the two of them broke up. And Rachel Bell, you took a look at that story. Apparently, she has never liked that giant house on Lake Washington.
Yes. So if you haven't heard, Bill and Melinda Gates are getting divorced. And, you know, I'm not interested in picking apart what might have happened. They've asked for privacy. I'm going to give them privacy. It's none of our business. But it's also not surprising because half of marriages end in divorce. And I looked it up. The CDC reports that last year in 2020, 746,971 couples got divorced. So big whoop. Gates. But I was intrigued by an article I saw in the New York Times about who will get the Gates family mansion, because in this article, it was made very clear based on interviews that have been done over the years that Melinda Gates never liked their house and always wished they lived in a normal sized house. So their home on Lake Washington is 66,000 square feet, and it's valued at $131 million. It's hard to even imagine how many square feet that is. And at the time of a 1995 New York Times story, which I will add in this article, they said they've been so private about their home that there haven't been a lot of sources to go to know what it's like in there. So we're going back to 1995. But at that time, there was a 60-foot pool, a gym paneled with stone from a mountain peak in the Pacific Northwest, a trampoline room, a stream for salmon, trout, and other fish. And according to a Microsoft intern who was allowed to go into the house in 2007 and talk about it, the sand on their beach is imported from Hawaii, and going down the driveway feels like arriving at Jurassic Park.
Yes.
So that's what we know about the home. But in the article, it says Ms. Gates once said that the mansion caused her to have a, quote, mini sort of personal crisis. And when she moved in with Bill Gates, he already lived there and he was working on the home. So I don't know if it was already 66,000 square feet or if they had added on since then. But when she arrived, she forced him to stop construction, make a newlywed feel as though she were living in site of video game. And she demanded that their home feel like a home for a family and children and not for a, quote, lone tech wizard.
Yeah, well, but he is a lone tech wizard. I figure that's one of the reasons you build a home like that, because you're going to be using it to meet with other tech wizards, and you got to impress them, don't you?
I suppose. I mean, it kind of makes him more well-rounded, because I always just think of him as a flat person that I read about who just likes to save the world and is really good at math and science, because I wouldn't have think of him as somebody who would want something super extravagant and would want to impress people, because I just think of him as a humble dork. But I guess that Melinda Gates is the humble dork here. So back in the 90s, he had this vision of making what sounds totally basic today, but in 1995, there was no such thing as a smart home. So he wanted all these things that exist today, like you could walk through the house and lights would dim or brighten and music would play and the temperature would adjust, all of these things. But it said that she never warmed to it. And in an interview in 2019, she said, "We won't have that house forever. I'm actually really looking forward to the day that Bill and I live in a 1,500 square foot house." So I'm curious to see. I'm sure we won't know, but it sounds like that's probably what she'll end up doing, is just buying a normal size house where hopefully she can have
privacy and security. I don't know if you can get that in a smaller house like that.
Just surrounded with a lot of land. But that was my favorite quote, because I've often wondered, because I know people who've built these giant houses, and I try to figure out, so do you really live in them, or is it like just spending your life in a hotel lobby? Because some of them,
there
are places in this town, like the Highlands, for example, that are the size of train stations. And I just don't know how you're comfortable in a place that big, to say nothing of, you know, taking care of it. You can't take care of it. You have to have servants and gardeners and stuff like that. And to hear her finally just fess up and say, you know, it's actually a lot more comfortable to live in a human-sized square house. I found that very refreshing.
I did, too. Could you put it in perspective, because I'm not good with this sort of thing, how big is 66,000 square feet? Can you compare that to something? Like, is that an airport?
That is 20 times the size of my house. But, of course, the whole purpose is to entertain people and to impress. And I read, you know, besides the other stuff, besides the imported sand, I think he had a fully grown tree moved like 6 feet so it wouldn't get in the way of the architectural plans from the coverage. It's because, Rachel, at that level of wealth, this is pocket change, right?
Yeah. I mean, don't even know how to spend it.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's the other thing. You have that much money, it takes a lot of effort just to figure out what to spend it on. And in terms of a house, most people's wealth is in their home, right? I mean, that's like going to be, what, 50%, sometimes 80% of your wealth. With him, it's a teensy-weensy fraction. You could even argue that at 66,000 feet, it's too small for a guy who's worth $150 billion. So, and plus, I don't think it's his only one, right? I mean, they have homes and pied-à-terres all over the world, don't they?
They must. I keep my wealth in my mouth. I have a very expensive gold tooth in the back.
Well,
and
see,
that's where I keep it. And I wear a night guard at night, and people think it's so I don't, because I grind my teeth, but it's actually to protect my only asset.
Of course. You don't want to grind away the gold. No. And
at least you
know where your wealth is. Most of us have
no
idea where it is. It's just numbers on a piece of paper. Yours is right there, as close as it can be.
I love tangible things.
Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.